All right. Welcome back to Punkonomics here.
Best songs.
I know. I'm horrible. That was David Byrne and Talking Heads with Life During the Wartime. And when we decided to go to the top of the hour public service announcements, we were talking in the background and stuff. And, you know, I wanted to ask you about, I know we're going to pick on Germany here, and I'm an instigator, but, you know, a lot of people in, like I was telling you earlier, a lot of people, you know, and particularly in school, and like I mentioned, my first economics class was yours, and it's actually about, propaganda.
It's non-major.
But it's non-major, right. But, you know, a lot of people in the U.S., don't know what the IMF is, which International Monetary Fund, and, you know, how, you know, everything's in a twine. But let's go to the Germans, because, we definitely need to talk about how they, accumulated their wealth and how the debt, got pretty much pushed off to the side. But go for it, Dr.
Ballack. Germans deserve a little bit of heat here. First, because they've been dishing it out in very uncomfortable ways, like, you know, calling all those southern people, you know, lazy and, it's kind of, you know, I don't know, started hearing Untermenschen, Übermenschen. Ooh, that's familiar vocabulary. Of course, they didn't use the exact words. It's just like in America, right? We say, oh, the president is not born in America.
Right.
I know what word you were looking for.
For exactly.
Yeah. They are the most powerful. They've benefited tremendously. They led Europe in many ways. Like I said, instead of providing a counterbalance, for whatever reason, for the benefit of the entire population of Europe, it would have been great if Holland and, you know, and France actually formed some united, no, let's think about all the people in Italy and Spain and Greece and what about them, but instead of kind of feeling superior, oh, we're cool and hardworking and Nordic like the Germans, we're now brothers with them, like back in the days we were Franks together. They were actually, they come from the same originally. Year like, you know, we're talking year 500 AD, all right? So it's not really that relevant other than in the symbolism in the head of people, yeah? But instead of that, they kind of were really happy to be invited to the, what I like to think of, that VIP lounge in Club Europe. Instead of saying, no, I'm staying with the people downstairs to make sure you don't go up to your head. We're all familiar a little bit with that phenomenon, right? We're all blah, 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 until we're invited and all of a sudden we accept the invitation, right? Okay, that's one thing. But there's tremendous duplicity about it. First of all, you know, it's not, the Greeks don't work less. Do they have a less efficient government? They work more, you know. Do they have a less efficient government and structure? Sure they do. I mean, they have a long history of problems. They were poorer. They had dictatorship. They were, you know, ravaged by, the Germans. World War II. So, you know, they had a lot of bag difficulties in picking themselves up. They did a decent job. I mean, nobody's perfect, etc. But then the European, monetary union as it developed, and it's a very complicated, long-stage process to create a union, you know, unless you want to go the American route of doing it.
Right.
Like Civil War?
Sure.
Try and avoid that one, right? Especially when you just had a world war going on there. Europe, you know, still remembers it, one should hope. And that was one of the reasons why a kind of a unifying club like that is important to establish, you know. We don't have it's not Christendom, and we can't, you know, ask the Pope to keep and there's Protestants today too, and other religions, and it's not what it used to be. So we have to have some kind of way of sticking Europe together, that they solve their problems peacefully, and then to be a big player, right? You have to be a bigger player. Individually, they're not big enough. A lot of their trade is internal, you know, so they kind of natural allies, etc. But especially when it became financial, when it became with the monetary union and all the stages towards that. That's when they really aberrantly started to really mess up. A mix of stupidity, by smart people. Yeah, we see so much of that, right? Stupidity by smart people, inability to see beyond your immediate interests, ugly stuff like that. So they set up the euro, their one currency, the thing where most Americans, I think, surely are familiar with about Europe, that they have one kind of money. They set it up really badly. They set it up at a time of boom, not, as I was saying before, not recognizing that there will be challenges. So they made it so tight, there's no flexibility to respond to a depression or recession or any kind of downturn. They didn't care in the central bank in Frankfurt really about how to deal with problems that will inevitably creep up in the weaker links of the European Union, such as Greece, but it's not alone, and we should definitely go back to there, because when Greece falls, that is the first domino. Alright? Mm-hmm. this is they're gonna be big, bigger than only this. And it ended up creating a situation where on the one, the benefit was that everybody now gets the Deutsche Mark. That used to be the money in Germany, the best currency in the world, really, in many senses. And maybe not, well, the dollar is special. Not the topic today, unless, you know, it comes up, right? Not the topic, why is the dollar so good? So powerful. The Deutsche Mark. Everybody wanted to have a Deutsche Mark. In Europe, everybody was thinking in Deutsche Mark, you know, saving in Deutsche Mark, if possible, you know. It was like almost, yeah, the real money of Europe for a long time. The idea was you lend out the credibility, the strength, the stability of the Deutsche Mark to all the countries of Europe. So they also have such wonderful a financial system, basically. Everybody gets to be German when it comes to finance. Wonderful. But of course, who benefits from strong savers, you know, investors? Long story short, the rich.
Right.
However, the other side of the coin of forcing a strong, stable, currency on countries that do not really have such a strong, stable economy that would have led them to have such a strong, stable currency raises prices. Again, I'm making so many shortcuts. So any kind of, you know, financial economist out there is right now tearing their hair out. I'm sorry.
And talking about economists, I got something here from the Bloomberg View, which you can take or leave it, right? But the headline reads, Germany deserves the debt relief. I'm talking about the 50s debt relief, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But Greece doesn't. And it goes on to say, Syriza's, Greece's new ruling party, they made a attractive argument for writing off the Greek debt. Wasn't Germany now the biggest opponent of the debt relief? Itself the recipient of unprecedented largest debt relief, which would happen in 1953, when its foreign debt was halves. Attractive, however, doesn't mean convincing. Parallels between today's Greece and 1953 Germany are demagoguery, pure and simple. Okay, and it goes on to say,
that's like propaganda, right? That's
The Federal Republic of Germany's creditors, 20 countries, including Greece, indeed agreed at a London conference to write off 55% of the country's 32.3 billion Deutschmarks of foreign debt. More than 50% of the Greek debt needs to be written off, says the top Syriza economist, John Milios. You know that guy?
Milios, yeah.
Yeah, sounds familiar, right? Mm-hmm. Anyway. Milio goes on to say that the solution was given to Germany at the London conference in 1953 is what we must do for Greece at this time. Apparently, you know, he gives his credentials. He went to college in Germany. He's a PhD and also at the University of Osnabrück.
It's
in
a
the
radical Texas. Position.
Right. But he goes on to say that half the total amount of German debt discussed at the London conference back then, 16.1 billion Deutsche Marks, came from before the World War II, and some of it had arisen from the unpaid reparations to the winners of World War I. Though some very high demands on German economy had helped the Nazis, who promised to do away with the reparations wind power, yet Konrad Adenauer, Germany's first post-war chancellor, had recognized that the debts in 1951 as part of an effort to turn Germany from ruin, debt-beat state to a responsible member of the Western world's economic system. It was a good will move. Much of the debt had been issued in currencies that later lost most of their value and interest from the years between the wars, and was hard to calculate. So, at NOAA, took on the obligations, at the, conversion rates acceptable to the creditors. It was recognized at the offset that Germany would not be expected to pay the full bill that would emerge from the purely technical reckoning of the outstanding debt. Yale's Timothy Guanin wrote in 2004 that the most authoritative paper to date on the 1953 debt write-off. As for the part, as the post-war debt, Frankfurt, Germany, current financial center and the seat of the European Central Bank looked like in 1953. And of course they show, you know, the whole bank in ruins and stuff. I guess they were trying to be dramatic about the whole thing.
Flattened.
Yeah, totally flattened. But Germany needed a lot of money to restore its infrastructure and housing, that was wiped out by the war. In some German cities, there were no pre-war buildings left apart from those painstakingly restored in the last 70 years.
So what is he saying then? I mean, no, yeah, frankly, I mean, again, this is like it's happened so much. All trees, no forest. You know, I mean, is it different? Of course it is, you know, but there are patterns that are similar. He's pointing to another episode, very important episode, right? After World War One, which is, incidentally, the Germans technically started, but then kind of fell down the rabbit hole. Everybody took them more seriously than they ever thought they would and kind of... Again, no excuse, I don't know, but I mean, the World War One was almost kind of by mistake, by stumbling through it, a little bit like now, frankly. Again, it's like us and Russia today, you know,
right.
Or maybe Greece and Turkey and Germany, and we'll talk again in 2 years and say, oh my God, you know, it's like ISIS in Berlin, you know, or something. Really, I mean, no, I mean, you know, I don't know. No, don't worry. I'm not going that crazy. But seriously, World War One was really a crumbling of an old world. The Germans technically did start it, but it wasn't on an expedition to conquer, you know, and create a new Third Reich like Second
right.
World War. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's true that this hit, and after the war, the Allies got together and decided to punish them for their transgression. Now understand, this is the Great War. I know people realize. I mean, go to any village in Europe, any little village in the continent of Europe, and you will find a memoriam, every single one, right? And on one hand you'll see the death of World War One, and on the other one you'll see the death of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And typically the ratio is like, you know, a hand, depending on the size of the village, of course, a handful of people from this village died in World War II, hundreds, half the village died in World War One.
Right.
I mean, you know, insane suffering, unnecessary, you know, the war to end all wars. It was really a shock for European culture. The Allies bled Germany pretty badly, in terms precisely of forcing them to pay reparations, for World War One. The only person sitting there and screaming blue murder about don't do this, what the hell you're doing about it, was the now famous, John Maynard Keynes. He was a junior, diplomat at the time, who explained that this is precisely, why are you doing it? You want to crush Germany? Turn it into a giant, failed, miserable country, this will only lead to catastrophe.
Right.
Duh. Guess what? Exactly said.
Right.
Exactly happened. Very nice. But still, and then this journalist is saying, okay, so it's different in that sense. First of all, Greece is pretty badly devastated too. Surely not in the way German was in World
right,
War II,
right.
Obviously.
It's not in shambles. Mm-hmm.
But wait a minute. First of all, let's stop here. You know, this is not the fault of anybody alive today or even most people who were alive then, you know, but my God, they started World War II, you know.
I know.
They kind of, a lot of people were for it. A good point to remember. The elites, the wealthy, the banksters, all of those one percenters that go, you know, that donate to the super conservative, all of those types in America, in Europe all supported the Nazi Party.
Right.
Before, when Hitler was still campaigning.
Right, know, right.
Supporting them with money, with a lot of things. Though maybe they were mistaken. Sure, most of them thought that he'll mellow out once he comes into power. Anything to stop the communists, or this fresh and scary thing, et cetera. But still, you know, I mean, a few years after they shut down the gas chambers and turned off the Panzers, they asked to be forgiven. And they were. Except for individuals that, you know, went to trial, war crimes, whatever, got hung, and et cetera.
No, at least the ones they caught.
A handful, again, you know, but this whole machine, and again, the whole companies, you know, what do you make of Siemens, you know, that built its entire business on producing, you know, gas weaponry, you know, what do you make of IBM, you know, when the punch card was invented? To, you know, how Jews in camps have a number on their hand?
Right. Mm-hmm.
The punch card was invented by IBM, who supplied machines to the camps to manage the numbers. All right, so what? You know, I had an IBM. Huh? I'm not saying but these responsibility when things go horribly wrong, like in a Nazism, it's a complicated thing that a lot of people are involved in. I mean, some more than others, sure, and some maybe have absolutely no guilt whatsoever. But it's a complicated social phenomenon. So now it's the same question about Greece. It would appear that despite, I don't believe how bad it went, really. I thought this was just a chicken game for the beginning, but then they're gonna be reasonable about it. Crushing Greece, because they can, is a bad option. So far, it seems that the European Central Bank, other international institution involved in international finance, related to it, are all for not learning that lesson that took us World War II to figure out not doing it again to Germany. So I don't really see the argument here. I want to bring kind of just real quick into this. The whole notion of debt forgiving is much bigger than Greece. The shock is that we're talking about Europe. This is something we've been talking for 30 years about the poor world. Now, as we go from a pretty poor world, I mean, there was improvements in, you know, a while ago, but all our goals from the heady 90s have been miserably failed. Poverty has doubled, instead of reduced. So the instability, jealousy, starvation, you're listening to crazy nutters who tell you insane stories and incite violence, that sort of thing rises. If Syriza fails in Greece, just for example, right? If they have time, right? They just got elected. They have time. But if it fails, they drop out and they have to manage a very painful, long, very painful transition. That's almost a lose-lose situation. How do you win a game like that? You know, I mean, how do you persuade people that, yeah, you hurt a lot, but I did my best and you hurt less?
Yes,
it's
right,
a very
right.
difficult thing for a politician to sell. But the other options are the neo-Nazis. In Greece, you know? Yeah. The other option in Greece is the neo-Nazis. So it's kind of, if Syriza fails, you think they're going back to the mainstream parties? No, because that failure of Syriza, either by dropping out in some way and telling the Germans, no, we will not submit to your authority. And again, the Europeans, let's drop off the poor Germans a little bit. Though with great power comes great responsibility.
Really, exactly.
Or if they capitulate, it's catastrophic. It's austerity. It's cutting all budgets, making everybody poor, sucking the any kind of liquidity, hope, and potential of building anything, reconstructing anything back into the European financial system to be redistributed up, as usual, into the wealthier section of Europe. So it will be gutting. They've been gutting Greece for years now. So why would you want them to comply? The other answer in Greece and in all other European countries, typically, and especially the poorer ones, and again, poorer, they're still the richest countries in the world, just poorer than Germany and France and Holland and like some tiny countries. All right. The next in line are Spain, that's coming up soon, and it looks like they're going to have Podemos, which is basically the same kind of real left. And again, not Stalinistic left, democratic left, you know, progressive, yeah? And above all, this is the other option to what we've been doing for a while now. One would say since the late 70s, others will say since the early 80s, and then ratcheted up later under Clinton, and then even more under Bush, whatever. It's been a miserable failure. And that's what's asked of them to do, and the mainstream media is presenting it as the rational thing to do. The rational thing to do is to, you know, run back head first into that concrete wall again and again. Of course, the dude deciding to do that again and again has a helmet. You know, a golden helmet or something, right? So it's not suffering from it. In fact, there's always and always has been opportunity for a few unscrupulous people to do very well from the suffering of others. The idea of a kind of a free market capitalist with all its flaws and major problems, but the core idea going back to Adam Smith era is that it's the only way to avoid it, to create a society in which you do not get rich and powerful by destroying and enslaving others, though that happened under capitalism too, right? But theoretically, that's not how it should work. That's why back when economists were not the scum of the earth like we were today, we were at the front lines of abolition of slavery, equality of women, and our argument, right, of course, I wasn't born, I'm talking here like 18th, 19th century, mostly 19th century, was that in a market economy, in a free market economy, whatever exactly that means, oh dear, we can create a society in which that doesn't hold. It's not zero sum anymore. You know, you could get wealthy and wealthy by treating your workers well, you know, and educating their children and getting higher tech, higher skilled labor instead of, you know, whipping them and sending them off to their plantations. But the temptation is always there. And that's, I think, what's like, in some sense, motivating the European elites, against Syriza, this alternative, and it's not so much ideological. We've got to try something else, and above all, stop austerity. Austerity is something that's not that well known in America. It is, if you will, the Tea Party.
Right, the
cut
Tea
budgets.
Party
all
model.
About the mm-hmm. budget. You got to cut budgets, and you know, cut taxes for the wealthy, and all of those things that are, you know, empirically proven to be, at least in our context, utterly foolish. So again, I'm saying it quite confidently. It's not because, oh, this guy, me, I'm a lefty or a right. No, not like that. Even a serious right winger would understand very well that that it would be, you know, you'd have to cut the tax burden in a very different way than the way we or Europe are doing it if we are to hope for the kind of effect that a right winger, kind of conservative thinker, would see as effective. So yeah, it's
you know,
bad that way.
I have a question. You know, like I was saying earlier, most people don't have a clue here as far as the economics and how it's all intertwined. But the IMF.
Anywhere.
Could you tell us a little bit about the IMF?
Well, I mean, again, you know, without going into kind of excruciating, irrelevant, I really think, I mean, and this is our focus, you know, more the forest than the tree, you know, just like you said, the York class, I mean, I do too, but I've become a specialist at kind of teaching non-majors, right? So my problem often is to go right to that real world issues. And I do not have a whole semester of having you do problem sets beforehand to lean on. I gotta go, okay, so, I mean, it's one of the International Monetary Fund. Its original idea was precisely to stabilize the economy. When a single country, a member country, is in trouble, everybody else kind of pools together and bails them out. Temporarily, surely. Sadly, so clever, you know, kind of part of the post, you know, big crises that, the previous school of mainstream economics, the classical economist, now it's neoclassical, the tradition, mainstream, they were the ones who were, you know, saw the Great Depression and said, that's okay, in the long run, things will equalize themselves and just don't do anything. It turned out to be a really, really bad idea. We didn't do it this time. People can criticize quantitative easing and Ben Bernanke and Barack Obama and George Bush and Hank Paulson or whatever. But no, we didn't repeat the idiocy of the response that the government, the economists did to the Great Depression. We did better. Not enough and not very well and, okay, but, so, the classicist always like, you know, everything goes back to equilibrium in the long run. Just let it be. Laissez-faire, coming from 18th century French theorist. Keynes, same Keynes,
okay.
Had a response to that comment. He said, yeah, right. In the long run, in your blackboard theoretical models, all the lines shift around and achieve and you go back to a new equilibrium and it's stabilized. But in the long run, we're all dead. He said, and that was kind of the core argument where he invented this notion that no, this is not like he wasn't talking about no, I want to change the system. I'm say a Marxist. No, he says I'm a full capitalist, full market capitalist guy, rich too, by the way, independently, and this is just we're not getting it. We're stupid. We need to figure out how the macroeconomy works. And you know, agree. Some people agree with some things, some less. But again, my serious non-anti-Keynesian Austrian economist friends, they read Keynes. They disagree, but they learn a lot first. You know what I mean? And they disagree with some of the things. Okay, but then I got a little bit lost. So yeah, IMF, right. Now, IMF ended up dealing with not so much their emergency funding type of thing. Yeah. I'm not going, no. He's handing me like this detailed kind of really scholastic thing. It's a summer vacation, dude. I'm wanging it. Ended up functioning more regularly with poor countries.
Okay.
Ex-colonies, poor countries around the world. And in a sense, they give you a loan, but with strings attached. And those strings are, what's the word for it? Because it's so confusing. In Europe, we call it neo-liberal, but in America, we call it neoconservative. It's kind of a hard, conservative in American politics, right? So again, you gotta cut taxes from your wealthy people, you got to cut programs, cut development programs. Of course, then the World Bank comes around the other side and has some corporate buddies that come in and they were designed to reconstruct Europe, and they did a pretty good job there. And then they specialized in global rape when it came to the ex-colonies after they'd done reconstructing Europe. In fact, the great economist, mainstream guy, not some radical, Stiglitz, he became the director of the World Bank. He quit after a year. He said, I came in there trying to, let's reform. How are we going to help the third world? This is the poor world. This is our mandate, isn't it? And then within a year, he realized, we're not helping them. We're making sure they stay hungry. We're doing everything necessary. It's the cynicism of it really hit him real hard. I mean, as an individual, as an intellectual, it really kind of hit him on the loop, you know, and had him question a lot of things. So there's indebting these countries, right?
Okay.
With unnecessary projects that actually, again, the money doesn't. We build an unnecessary big infrastructure project in the middle of the jungle somewhere. And in order to pay for it, the country gets into deep debt. The IMF funds it, that then controls them, holds them by the you-know-what.
Mm-hmm.
But the wealth really all went from the bank account of the IMF to the bank account of some kind of rich world construction company that built the unnecessary.
So let me put this in perspective. So basically, in a nutshell. The IMF basically just goes in there and just squeezes off all the money for the infrastructure, you know, all the unemployment benefits. They tell them, hey, you know, you can't do that, cut over here and all that. Then they get the World Bank to come in and set up all the
more the specific development programs.
Right.
Yeah. IMF is responsible for policy. It tells the government, we'll lend you money, but now you have to have a hardcore, hard right conservative, economic policy, because this is how you do it. This is how you develop. And there is when I get crazy. I get crazy. You know, the show, I kind of come out, do I come out as happy but this drives me crazy because hold on here for a moment. In history, no country ever has gone from underdeveloped poverty rural, small manufacturing, whatever, to a developed status. What we call right, development, right? Where you have productive industry, you have good infrastructure, decent at least infrastructure, all of those things we associated with a modern capitalist state. You could associate it even with a dictatorial, Stalinistic Soviet Russia. He took a Renaissance level country, and in 5 years turned it into a powerhouse. A lot of people died. Freedom was non-existent. Misery was abundant. It was a nightmare, but he took a poor, rural, weak country,
right, weak country,
in very dictatorial, harsh methods. But that's special, China to some extent. That's special, right? Other than all other countries, sorry about the weird noises. No country in history has ever developed economically without significant centralized guidance from their government, managed, not free, not liberal. The recipe the IMF is giving the poor world is we are rich, we are American, Swiss, French, German, we are, shall we go Heidegger, Lasse? German. Listeners just fell off the chair, I'm sorry. It's not dirty, it's just disturbing. Superior race. Is what I mean. Holy race, I think. I messed up. My German is very weak and very rusty. But anyway, so you read the level of the racket? And people think, right? Some people will say, look at South Korea. They developed and stuff. They're a capitalist democracy and stuff. Completely centrally planned to the hilt. Zero economic freedom. Everything centrally managed and with no economists.
Right. We have no economists.
All centrally. Japan. Okay, so recent ones, right? Wait. America. The United States of America. Heavy. Hamilton, like him or not. I mean, Jefferson's the cool guy. Hamilton's kind of the dork. But when it comes to finance, he saved this country. He built it. Alright? Britain. The first heavy policy, So if it was, we should, and in America too, No, we shouldn't open our borders completely to cheap exports and outsource, or we shouldn't allow companies to outsource. Oh, you want to shut down your factory in Ohio and ship it to a slave labory compound in China and you already set up subsidiary for it? No, you don't. No, sorry. Not allowed. Can't do it. Right? So now, now you're controlling capital. You're not allowing capital to leave your country. Americans feel this. A lot of Americans feel this, right? I mean, I actually read recently that a majority of Americans don't believe in free trade agreements as we play this crazy game with the new ones, right? The two, right? One Atlantic, one Pacific. So Americans feel that. Well, that has been forced on the poor world by the IMF since the 60s. Right? And a lot of other horrible things happen at the same time to go with it. That's the clean part. Then you have the economic hitmen also, but that's more for strategic reasons. But they hold hands, They have a drink at the bar in the Ritz,
in whatever poor
country it is, after working. The IMF dealing with the Ministry of Finance, explaining them, you need this amount of money, these are the conditions you're going to have to meet, and the local government, prime minister or whatever, saying, but I can't do this to my people. I can't do this to my people. Sorry, then no money. And if you haven't been persuaded, check out the gentleman here who will tell you, I work for some private contracting company. This is not recent. This is not post-Snowden. This is going on since the 60s.
So the racket is similar to when we go and blow up a country and then set up Burger King to McDonald's afterwards.
The reconstruction racket, though it's gone beyond it in a sense. In some sense, now we're destroying. We started with Saudi Arabia, right? We're setting the world on fire. We're not even bothering reconstructing it anymore.
Right.
And part of it, I believe, is, if your economy is based on selling stuff, electronics, whatever, right? Goods and services, anything. Doesn't have to be sexy. Well, you have that interest. If you have a country that's in shambles due to war or whatever, you want to build it up because it's a very good investment. Famously, right? I mean, when the Marshall Plan rebuilt, you know, Europe, America should get the credit, General Marshall, of coming up with this plan should get the credit of doing the right thing.
Right.
You know, the honorable thing. But at the same time, it was a very smart thing. That investment paid back with massive interest. So he made a lot of money for America by doing good. This is Smithian capitalism. This is it. This is it. You know, that's the animal, that precious bird that is easy to kill. You know, of do the right thing and make money. It's not a trade-off.
Right.
You can do it together. That's Adam Smith's great idea. It's possible, he said. And then he spent two very voluminous, serious books to explain how it's possible. But, oh, my God, how many things could go wrong so easily. Especially, he understood quite well to what extent elites that are powerful have an interest in the possibility of capturing the system. And for them, actually, slavery... pre-capitalist is a better deal. You get even richer, you know, than being a, and today we see the great bankers who destroy, who do not produce, the great outsourcers or what the business engineers, right? The guys who come into a company and rearrange it.
Oh, right, right.
I have a friend who makes a hell of a lot of money doing this. And when we ask him, you know, at dinner or whatever, so, oh, man, what do you do? What do you do for a living? Or somebody he says, I do human trafficking. He's a cool guy, but you know, but in some sense, he does evil, you know, and he knows it. So all of that stuff, again, not constructing. I like to, you know, I've slammed in since the beginning of the show into Barack Obama a lot, but let's bring Romney in, right? I mean, people think Romney was a good businessman. Good for whom? Romney destroyed millions, literally millions, right. By some estimates, 4.5 million jobs in America. He didn't produce anything ever. He bought American industry, destroyed it, and sold it for scrap. That's how he made his wealth. So, you know?
Yeah, he was sort of like the Gordon Gekko of the 80s.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Not Hollywoodized like
right,
that, you know?
Right.
But basically, that's absolutely right. So we're doing now to Greece and soon probably to Spain. And after that, I don't know, possibly to Portugal, probably very quickly after Spain because they're close. Ireland is on the brink of joining this unhappy club. And Italy. Italy is what, the 5th, 6th, 7th? Things change fast in this modern age of ours, economy in the world. And it's a mess, but it's very big. I mean, that's that domino effect I'm talking about.
Who do you think
is
gonna be
scary stuff?
Who do you think is the next one that's gonna fall?
Well, after Greece. What do you mean by fall, essentially, right? I mean, the countries will suffer more. If Greece leaves, that damages the European Union, right? I mean, there's a massive hit, financial hit, to the rich countries, primarily because they hold the credit,
right? Mm-hmm.
So how would that ripple through the system? It could in so many ways. It can get really complicated. Understand that I keep saying really complicated, not because I'm an economist and I know this stuff and I'm so smart so I can deal with complicated stuff. No, I'm trained actually and published as a methodologist, you know, a guy who's trying to figure out how do we do science, how should we do science, what methods are valid, what aren't, yeah? Method. And in fact, one of the main problems why the textbook is 80% bunk, like I said, is that it has hubris, as the ancient Greeks said. Unjustified pride. That we think we know. Well, we should realize we don't.
Right.
We don't. And, you know, Socrates, I think, had a saying about the beginning of wisdom is knowing how stupid you are. You know?
Right.
So really, we don't. It's complicated in, I'm saying complex, not as in a technical term, you know, like a mathematical term. Yeah? It's impossible to describe with no matter how many differential equations. It's that complicated. It's chaos theory. Yeah, that's what I made popular in Jurassic Park, the first one. There's a new one out. I haven't seen it yet. Out or soon. Anyway, so we have to build systems that are more robust because we can't control. We don't understand the details. So if we build systems that are fragile, they blow up. It's a great book by one of my favorite conservatives, actually, Nassim Taleb, ex-bond trader. So he, you know, both academic and practical knowledge and... he deals a lot with this, with finance. And Corey actually, is also a fan of him. He pushed, his working on, anyway, he has this notion of fragile and his new book is anti-fragile, about building systems that are robust. I mean, you look at biology, you see we are robust in many ways. Redundancy is for one. You know, we you imagine the amount of power we could have, we could squeeze out of our muscles if we ran our blood pressure at 200 PSI or something. The problem is that, you know, if you had some kind of arterial degeneration, you'll blow up. Right? We have two ears. Well, that's for 3D, I suppose. We have two testicles. Why? Spare.
Just in case.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of that going on in the body. Our body is full of redundancies. Biological systems are built when things happen, when random stuff happen, when bad things happen, when chaos happens, that turmoil makes the system stronger. In fact, evolution itself is based on that principle. But many times when we build our financial system based on these Ayn Randian / Austrian / Chicago school belief, you know, Alan Greenspan, etc., and not all Austrians, once again, I do my typical disclaimer. No. not the good ones. We built a fragile system, a system that with every little hit becomes a little bit more fragile until it will inevitably collapses.
You know, I just did a Google search just for the fun of it. Who is the next Greece? And for what I notice here, nobody seems to know. The speculation that Spain, no. They go as far as saying California.
No.
No. Yeah, there.
In America, we don't do this. You know what? That's a great point to raise, because in America, we don't do it. So many people, especially liberals, by the way, think that Europe is this kind of bastion of socialist, progressive, you know, free love, some kind of, you know, hate Ashbury,
my own neighborhood.
Yeah, or something. I'm making a bit of fun. Even
right.
Scandinavians are by far, you know, in every measure, you know, the best economies in the world today. And they have some advantages that were by luck, no doubt, et cetera, et cetera. But even they aren't what they used to be. Though they're still better than most. In terms of just the standard of living, the wealth of their citizens. All of them. But Europe is no longer that. I mean, do they have some things that are still on the book? I mean, right now, as you look at Facebook, you get the endless, you know, like, oh, you get, like, maternity leave. I mean, we're compared, you know, you have minimum wage, you have all of these kind of things. Oh, every civilized country, certainly in Europe, has this. We don't have it. And fine, yeah, we're sure.
Right.
But a lot of them have been stripped, or not yet. They can't strip it, you know? I mean, they wouldn't do it now if they could, but they can't. But essentially, in Europe, the Tea Party won, like, over 10 years ago already, all out. So imagine, I think Rick Wolf actually does a comparison, or was it Doug Henwood, about that. I mean, we're not like, when there's a depression in cities, except for Detroit, by the way, and Baltimore, I mean, so we have these inklings, but we don't, like, come in and suck all the money out of Alabama because we can. I mean, imagine, I know Texans have been saying that Obama's invading them or something, but he doesn't. He doesn't even,
right.
You know, we're together, and the FEMA will come and help you. We're not like that. We're not like, oh, yeah, but you're going to pay me with interest. You know,
right. I mean,
this country has been forged into a single economy with very diverse groups and what have you. But in Europe, they're still fighting it. And so this notion that we have a hard time right now, our system is falling apart, and we're going to take it out. We're going to just use the blood of a victim to fix it. Think about it here a minute for Americans, you know? I mean, nobody's ganging up on, you know, Mississippi to you know, shutting down their running water and electricity in order to cut the budget deficit. It's not. No, it doesn't make sense.
Right, it's not happening, yeah.
But the obsession with deficits, a lot of these are very weakly verified scientifically, these approaches, this kind of in America, the, you know, the teabagger economics. That would be a good title for a course, actually. It could be a fun course. Teabagging economics.
Teabagging economics.
It would be fun just to see if it'll pass into the catalog, or I would get a polite email saying, professor, and like, I don't think you can do that.
And needless to say, the tea party, I should say, are well-intended. You know, it's just that they're a little bit misguided.
Well, the people.
Right.
They're supporters. Frankly, their leadership is overwhelmingly fake and corrupt and in the worst sense. Again, I mean, betraying their own standard. You know, I'm betraying their own criteria. I mean, if you want a much smaller government, fine. Actually, I happen to agree with much smaller, but then I also agree that you have to have government and you have to have good government, essentially. Now, I, being a syndical anarchist politically, so I'm gonna, you know, small government communist, I like to finally, so it's not really correct either, but I'm afraid of big government. I think it should always be very minimal.
Minimal, right.
But there are a lot of things that government must do, and it must do well. Mm-hmm. That's what led countries in the past to develop and others not to. You know, that's why when the IMF and the World Bank and other institutions comes into poor countries and propose what they need to do, and then actually more than propose, because either dangle money at them or kill the prime minister and then come visit the next one and say, would you like a bag of money? Or
end up
a
like him. Yeah.
What do you like better? it's totally fake. You know, we're not that. Often I teach very dismal science. I teach the state of real world, the real world. I teach real world economics, right? Sometimes I get so depressed I want to go back to theory. Man, let's do the math, you know, math. But it does get depressing. The racket is. It's complete. I mean, nobody has developed like that. There's no way to really envision realistically how anybody would be able to alleviate poverty and develop and become wealthier and more productive and, you know, do well, given these policies. And you have a lot of true believers. The schooling system overwhelmingly indoctrinates this dogma, which is the correct technical term, by the way, for it, from its Catholic term. It's the view of the world dictated by the Pope, and this is true, and if you don't believe that, you're going to hell.
Right, right.
Straight up, you know? But of course, we are neoclassical and quote-unquote free market, because I'm always, I hate to use free market as a dirty word, because it sounds like it's a beautiful thing, theoretically, in the 18th century, but the way we use it, you know, we use it in the worst possible way. Just like communist countries back in the day used to always call themselves the, you know, the Democratic Republic. There's
right,
no
right.
democracy. You know, but they call themselves so democratic, right? So in that sense, it's a racket. It can't work. There's no reason. There's a lot of people who believe it. There's a lot of people who learned it in school and thus, you know, are indoctrinating into believing it. Once again, like you were saying before, it's like a religion. It becomes an article of faith, but there's a good reason why, famously the American founding fathers were so adamant against, for the separation of church and state. Not because they hated the church. I mean, church and state must be separate for both as benefits, because when they aren't, they bleed into each other. They destroy each other. Yeah? So a lot of it. So there's a long record of this. It doesn't work. Austerity. It's kind, you know, fiscal conservatism in the long run is doesn't help. It doesn't solve the problems it's supposed to. It's difficult. The world's changed. You know, maybe it worked. Okay. Now I'm gonna lose. You know. Oh dear. I'm sorry, but I'm not sure I'm right about it. But I'm entertaining ideas that are against my views. I do that. That's called critical thinking.
Right.
Maybe Ronald Reagan and Maggie Thatcher had a point back in the 70s. Well, we lived in a very different economy.
And a different world.
You know. Mm-hmm. In macroeconomics, in the general, you know, not the, right, the macroeconomic study, the entire economy. It very much depends what state of the world you're in when it comes to which policy. People, I know students like glaze over. It takes me a while to You know, how come we don't get this? Or we should, you know? The same kind of, in an economy that's very hot, as we say, and we're not talking sexy here, we're talking about there's a lot of jobs, wages are going up because companies are competing over people, you can't produce enough goods to sell, it's so wonderful, right? In an economy like that, in the 60s, let's say, in America, and you have very high taxes on wealthy people, relatively, to other parts of the world, right? And Kennedy actually reduces them. And it works. It stimulates the economy. Because, you know, they barely are investing as fast as they can, you know, so more liquidity. Okay, we can accelerate our investment. We're building more factories, creating more jobs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But doing that in an economy that is morose, that is cold and half dead, really, you know, makes no sense.
Right.
We have zero interest rates. You should... Hey, anybody out there also taking debt? A lot of people do. Well, so does the government. Should respond to the same thing, right? Ooh, let's refinance. The rates are so low. Put that money into something that, with time, will be productive and useful, right? It's not ideological, you know. I'm so right wing. I don't want government to, because they're just too stupid and bureaucratic. And they got okay. Wait, let's create tax incentives for private companies to do it. Then, you know. Though, frankly. Some things just don't happen without straight up. But I'm open-minded. You know, despite, like I said, you know, it was always through good, relatively good government or management that countries developed into capitalist, modern, developed countries, without exception. The only exception I was saying before was some of them didn't develop into capitalism, they developed into socialism, but a minority, but they did develop through government control. But this is a given. The same thing goes for these macroeconomic policies. It doesn't matter what I'm willing to be open-minded. Tell me how we can do it differently, you know, even if we've never done it like that before. How can you do research and long-term research and development and infrastructural development without public schools, massively funded, like NASA, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, all of that stuff. Many Americans don't realize that at the most conservative measure, 80% of all innovation and technology around us is 100% government funded.
Right.
And that's very conservative because the real number is more like in the mid-90s. And that includes your iPhone.
Yep.
Right? So... it's important. We must learn economics is one thing. Things are going to get excited. I'm surprised. I'm always the pessimist in the room, and I was sure they're going to come up with some kind of decent compromise where they both can go home. But like from the Arab Peninsula to Frankfurt, it looks like the lunatics have taken over the asylum. I wish you had the special song to play right now, but that would be asking too much.
No, but I have what Joey Ramon probably would have done, which is I want to be sedated. Anyway.
No, we have to fight.
Right, we have to fight. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
No.
So anyway, thank you for listening to Punkonomics. Remember, Punkonomics is always every Wednesday from 2 to 4. Punkonomics.org, Facebook, whatever.
Twitter.
Yeah, stay in contact.
Tumblr.
And all that. And hey, Julie Norris is here.
Yep.
And she's
patiently waiting.
Patiently waiting, and she's
not whacking us on the back of the head.
From that level of economics to I just came back from the localist conference.
You did?
Yeah.
Oh.
That's great, because that's one of the things that need to be done big time.
And you know, we've been asking Julie to come on our program, so maybe we can put some pressure on her now that we have on the air. Anyway, Julie Norris is coming up with Front Porch Radio. Stay tuned. Punkonomics, and we're out of here.
Yep.